Hey, Anna, there are three heavenly bodies that can come between us and the sun. Name them.
Between us and the sun.
Between us and the sun.
Okay, the moon.
The moon, that's right. Number one, because we just had that big eclipse.
We did.
What are the other two?
I know the others. It's Venus and Mercury.
That's right. Exactly. You got it.
Oh my gosh, where's my car?
This is pretty good. Yeah, so those are the only three natural objects, the only three heavenly bodies can come between the Earth and the sun.
Wow.
We had the moon go in front of the Earth on August 21st, making that solar eclipse. And then the two planets close to the sun, Mercury and Venus, can come between them. And they're called transits when this happens. It looks like little dots, little black dots going across the sun.
Oh, my gosh.
So the next time this will happen, the next solar eclipse is going to be a partial eclipse on February 15th, 2018.
There's a partial one in 2018?
2018, visible from Antarctica. Sorry. And then, that's a downer, I know.
I got excited for that.
And then the transit of Mercury, the next time Mercury goes between us and the sun, is 2019.
Okay.
And then the next transit of Venus is going to be 2119.
So you're saying I won't be available.
Sorry, you're not going to make it. Neither of us. Oh, well.
But didn't we just have one recently?
We did have a transit in 2012 and a 2004. Okay. Those are the only two transits of Venus in our lifetime. So that's it. We're done.
Ending on us.
Put a fork into us. Right. We're done with the transits.
Wow.
Anyway, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up. I'm Dean Regas.
And I'm Anna Heeman. In this episode, we'll talk about August's total solar eclipse and talk with author David Barron about his book, American Eclipse. Plus, we'll pull a question from the observatory's crank file. All right, so we're fresh off a little thing called the Great American Eclipse.
Oh, man, I can't believe it. August 21st, what a day.
What a day.
I can barely even think, like, what life was like before that, right?
We'll go with that. Fine. Yeah. So, I mean, how did it go? I mean, this is 17 years in the making for you.
Yeah.
I need to know.
I had been waiting a long time.
That's
actually
right.
I found out it was longer than that. I had this on my calendar since 1999 because I saw a partial eclipse, August 11th, 1999. And then that's when I was like, wait a second, when's the next total in the U.S.? So it's about 18 years that I've been waiting for this. So it was great. It was great. But how was it in Cincinnati? How was the partial stages here for you?
I mean, you know, it was. I know it was partial, and you got to think total. But I have to say, it was pretty.
Somebody's a little bitter still.
It's like somebody's off doing whatever. But at the observatory, it was incredible. We had 1,500 people.
Wow.
Everyone was. No one was looking, you know, you're used to people seeing them look down at their phones. They were all looking up at the sun.
Oh,
for
that's awesome.
It was amazing. And we actually ended up, you know, closing our buildings for a period of time so people could really focus on, you know, what was totality for us or the peak. And it was just incredible. Like, it got cooler, which I was, frankly, I was psyched about. It was like 92 degrees.
Oh, it was so hot that day.
So hot.
So have a little breeze,
exactly.
A little cooler.
And there was like weird shadow or like it was shaded weirdly. It felt not dark, but kind of a weird time. It was just... But it was incredible to see through the glasses and the welder's glass.
Then leading up to the event, I mean, all the calls we got at the observatory, people like demanding eclipse glasses.
Yes.
They were breaking down the doors. They were like selling them in the parking lot. It was all scalping. I mean, it was crazy.
It was crazy.
I don't think I'd ever seen that much of a response out of the public for any event. And I was prepared a little bit, but I thought, man, people got eclipse crazy over this.
Oh, my gosh. I think that they were just really excited about that it was this phenomenon, but I feel like a lot of people wanted us to prove to them how unique it was. I feel like a lot of people were like, you know, sort of like, what, you know, why is this so, such a big deal? But then, like, as it got closer, people just got super amped about it.
Yeah.
And we took so many phone calls.
Oh, God. The phone was ringing off the hook.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you weren't answering it, but the rest of us were you were just like, whatever, I'm planning my trip.
I let it ring.
Yeah, you're like, I think the phone's ringing again, guys.
What's that noise? That's what I was saying,
pretty
much. It's
a weird sound.
It just keeps going. So the observatory, we gave out over 12,000 eclipse glasses to the city and the people around. And I mean, it wasn't enough. We could have given out twice as many or three times as many.
Oh, heck yeah.
It was crazy.
We could have made some pretty good money on the side, frankly, if we had gotten industrious or, you know, entrepreneurial, whatever the phrase would be, you know.
I'm thinking ahead, Heyman. Mm-hmm. I think we got this all figured out. Retirement 2024.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
Glasses out the back of the truck. It's going to be, see us.
I can't wait. And people will be like, what's going on? How are you like, don't worry about it. We got our thing going on.
Suddenly there's no eclipse glasses in the whole country because they're all in the back of my car.
That's right. In your Prius.
This would be great. This would be perfect.
Exactly.
But so, yeah, so like what other, so it was 91% in Cincinnati. And so like, what did people think like when it was like getting, you know, a little slightly darker? It wasn't super dark. 91% was still pretty bright, but like people stayed to the max. Did they like kind of, was there any hooting, hollering? Was there, or is this kind of, people were just studying, they were like looking up there and they're like, wow. And
yeah, people, it was funny because they were, I think,
was it a mellow crowd or was it a
I think a lot of people didn't actually get a chance to really start looking until it was getting to that peak moment.
Oh, yeah.
So by the time I kind of, you know, went outside and was able to join everybody, people were like, oh my gosh, look at it. That's so cool. Or that's amazing. You know, like, so that was really fun.
Yeah. The beginning's a little, you're like, oh, there's a little bite out of the sun. But yeah, if you get in at like 80% or 90%, that's pretty cool. And then you had the eclipse glasses, you had telescopes.
Welders. Yeah.
With filters on it, all sorts of stuff. Oh man. Well, that sounds good. So now you're ready to see a total one, right?
Yeah. I was like, you know, this is cute. this is really fun, but you know what I'm really looking forward to is 2024.
Your fear of missing out. That's what got you. Probably.
I have serious FOMO.
Yeah.
And I almost texted you that morning. Like I got some serious FOMO, but instead I said, I hope this is like great for you or whatever.
I hope this is great for you.
What I was really thinking was, I really wish I had just like could get in my car and just head down there.
You totally suck. That's
exactly,
what that means.
Yeah.
You selfish astronomer.
Right.
Saw this all to yourself.
Mm-hmm. You know what else is in totality? How much you suck right now. Okay, that was kind of mean. Yeah, sorry.
Well, that's all right.
Well, tell me about what happened with you. I mean,
I do feel bad.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
You're psyched.
I like sharing these things with lots of people, but I also have to have clear skies. I couldn't jeopardize that. Like
we had clear skies here. It was actually a crystal clear, gorgeous day.
Perfect.
But fine.
It was
perfect.
So I was watching the weather because I was going to make a last minute decision.
I was very noncommittal.
Mm-hmm. I didn't tell anybody.
You really didn't.
I didn't want to share. Actually, I really didn't.
I could tell because people kept asking you.
Yeah, and I said, oh, I don't know. Maybe I'll be in Oregon. Maybe I'll be in Wyoming.
Just picking random U.S. states.
But so I was looking for the weather anywhere between South Carolina and Nebraska. That was my travel zone. And it looked like Nebraska and Missouri was looking good. So I kind of told people, okay, I'm going to go that way. And then the weather changed and I turned into the fair weather person. I said, sorry, folks, I got to go where it's clear. And so I end up in Franklin, Kentucky. So it's just north of the Tennessee border, very close to Cincinnati, which was nice too. And luckily our coworker's dad had a extra hotel room. So I lucked out and got a hotel room too.
Man, so everything just works out for you.
It worked. The heavens will provide.
That's right. You did get that random invite from somebody that like you could stay at their house.
That's true. I did get an invite from a stranger to stay in at their house. And I did not take that up on it, but that was very nice.
It was very nice.
People were very accommodating to astronomers.
Yeah, they were excited.
So anyway, I stayed in this Quality Inn in Franklin, Kentucky, and we asked, oh, can we use your backyard to look at the eclipse? And it's this big field, is about like 100 feet by 100 feet field. Mm. And they're like, yeah, sure, you can set up. And so there's about 50 people in this yard. And
oh, wow.
So I brought a few telescopes and some people brought some glasses. And so it was so hot. It was so blazing hot. And then all of a sudden we realized, wow, it's really pleasant outside. Like, this is nice. When it was about 85% blocked, then it started getting cooler. The wind died down. It was just really eerie. And then as it gets darker and darker, you're starting to see the shadows are really sharp. You're starting to see the light is so eerie that it's like purple lavender color. Wow. And everybody's form, you're looking at people and they just don't look right. They look like
Did you tell anybody you don't look right?
Well, they look like they're in 2D or something like that. They just look very stark. Mm. Everything was very stark. And so then a few minutes before totality, I looked up. I could see Venus with the naked eye,
bright
as can be. Then we saw Jupiter pop out. And then so then the whole crowd there was, you know, they said, well, you'll tell us when it starts, right? I was like, Yeah, yeah, sure. I'll do that. I'll do that.
What does that mean?
Well, I was the guy with the telescope, so I looked like I knew what I was doing. And so I said, well, sure, I'll try. And so I, because this is my second one, so I knew a little bit, but it had been a long time since the last one. So I had the timing down and everything like that. But then it just started like right all, and I was rehearsing what I was going to tell people, like, oh, behold the heavens and the dance,
you had, like,
the cosmic dance plays out. And instead, when it happened, all I could say was, it started. Look at it. That's all I could say. That was the only words that I said.
Are you kidding? You had prepared a speech.
I had a whole speech, but
was it like a soundtrack in the back of the speech? And you were
struck,
like, forget it.
Struck dumb. It was the dumbest thing I'd ever said. Look at it.
You just said look. You didn't say keep looking up.
I just said look at it. It started. Look at it. That's all I said.
Well, I mean, that's direct.
So, and it was unbelievable. I mean, just like, it's like the heavens like close up. It's it's like this whoosh happens. It's the soundless like thing that total blackness. And you look up and the sun's all gone. And it was just, it was 2 minutes and 30 seconds where I was there, where the sun's gone and you could see the corona coming around the sun, and we could see a couple stars. And then that was when you can take the glasses off and stare right at it. And so I even aimed a pair of binoculars, and you could see some of the little eruptions, the prominences coming around the sun, around the moon. And I took three pictures during totality, and then and it was it. It was over. It's over. Man. And so everybody's yelling and hooting and hollering and
crying. Really?
Oh my God! It was like,
did you cry?
I was speechless. Okay. I couldn't after I said look at it. I could not say another word. I was like,
clearly.
I did have tears going down I couldn't. I was choked up, and so then and then afterwards we celebrated, and everybody was just like, oh, it's too soon. It's too fast. If only it was longer. I wish it was longer.
Oh, Lord.
So, boy, it was great. So we'll have to get ready for the next one. You will be there. We'll be there together, wherever that is.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in for totality.
2024.
Yeah, I'm putting in my days now.
Good.
I'm going to, send something out and say, I'm not available.
Right.
I'm going to be...
Yeah,
checking this out.
Yeah, whoever is lowest on the totem pole at the observatory has to stay then. Exactly. So you're moving your way up.
Like me, yeah, like I was this time.
Whoops.
7 years from now,
you just figured that out.
Yeah, that was sweet. Yeah, oopsie. Thanks. All this hard work for low man on the totem pole.
But by then, you'll have risen.
Oh yeah, There's the no problem. Oh man.
So let's keep talking about eclipses, but this time we're going to go back 139 years. Let's welcome David Barron, author of American Eclipse.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So your book, American Eclipse, that just came out recently, is about the eclipse of 1878. And so why did you choose that date and that eclipse to highlight?
Well, so, I mean, when I first had the idea to write a book, an eclipse-related book, to come out in time for the eclipse of this year, I was looking around, frankly, for a really good eclipse story to tell. Mm-hmm. And I looked at a number of eclipses that occurred in the 19th century, which was a time when total eclipses were really important for science. But the one in 1878 just had it all, as far as I was concerned. It was, across the Wild West. So, here you had America's scientists heading out to, still a pretty rough part of the country and having their adventures out there. The scientists who went out for the eclipse were just fascinating characters, Thomas Edison and others who we'll probably get into. But also it was a time when America was just starting to get its act together in science. And that eclipse in 1878 really helped bring the country together with the idea of us taking on Europe and becoming a scientific power. So from the characters, the setting, and the importance of the event, I just thought it had it all.
Yeah, as I was reading, that was kind of the theme that I got, was that this was an eclipse where Americans had something to prove. Is that where you kind of thought about it too?
Absolutely. I mean, the individual scientists had something to prove, but the whole nation had something to prove. We really had kind of an inferiority complex when it came to how we were perceived as a country in intellectual affairs. And Europe, frankly, looked down their noses at us when it came to literature and art and music and science.
Yeah, so we had a country without culture, wasn't it? Something like that they called us?
That's, yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, there was, and frankly, you know, and Americans kind of felt the same way. This was the Gilded Age, and we tend to think of that term today as being sort of a positive thing.
But sounds positive. Meant that mm-hmm. Oh, that was a slam?
Oh, yeah, Mark Twain came up with the term Gilded Age, and he meant it as, you know, that we were sort of, we looked sort of glittering on the outside, but we had no substance inside. We were just this thin layer of gold over a worthless interior that, you know, we were making lots of money, but frankly, as a nation, we didn't know what to do with the money. We had no, you know, we weren't striving to be a great country in terms of advancing civilization. So that's kind of what the eclipse was about, proving that we were more than just a country with a Gilded Edge.
And so there was a lot of these East Coasters and Midwesterners that went out to the Wild West, right? So it's Thomas Edison and some other astronomers that went out there. And so there was folks at Pikes Peak. What were they doing up at Pikes Peak?
Well, funny you should ask that, because there's a Cincinnati connection. Yes, so some of the folks who went out west, you know, the Path of Totality that year went right over Pikes Peak, over 14,000 feet high in Colorado. And there were folks from what was then the early National Weather Service, which was part of the Army back then.
And this was not easy to get to, right? I mean, this wasn't like a...
Yeah, 14,000 feet. Yikes.
Yes, but there actually was a weather station on the top that was manned year-round and a telegraph line coming all the way down the mountain to Colorado Springs. So it was a group organized by the Weather Service, which, as I say, was part of the Army. And one of those folks used to be the director of the Cincinnati Observatory, and that was Cleveland Abbey.
Oh, yeah, our buddy Cleveland.
Yes, so Cleveland Abbey, who in the late 1860s was the director of the Cincinnati Observatory back when it was on Mount Adams, mm-hmm. before it moved, he was, even though he was trained as an astronomer, he was a pioneering meteorologist, and he, when he was at your observatory, as you know, started the first daily weather forecasting service in the country. And he then took that to the U.S. government and became the chief meteorologist for the National Weather Bureau. And he, in 1878, went up Pikes Peak with a couple of other astronomers to observe the eclipse from up there, although he had a hell of a time because he had to deal with snowstorms in July and terrible, terrible altitude sickness.
Yeah, so he wasn't able to stay on the peak.
All that work.
Well, yeah, I mean,
and so I could just picture, I mean, because I'm a very stubborn eclipse chaser, so like I wouldn't let anything stop me, but he's up there at 14,000 feet, and then what happens?
Well, he had very serious altitude sickness. I mean, I actually, in the course of writing my book, spoke to a doctor, a specialist in altitude medicine, to make sure I was diagnosing Cleveland Abbey's condition correctly. And he said, yes, Cleveland Abbey quite clearly had what's known as high altitude cerebral edema, where his brain was swelling against the interior of his skull and was causing, you know, terrible headaches. He was debilitated. He could not get up. But another symptom of it is you lose your ability to reason. You don't think straight. And he didn't realize how sick he was. And he wanted to stay up on the mountain, but he was ordered down, thrown on a stretcher and carried halfway down the mountain the very night before the eclipse.
And that probably saved his life, actually.
Yeah, and he had a very good view, actually, from 10,000 feet.
Happy ending.
He was still stuck on his back. He couldn't get up. He left his good spectacles up on the summit. But he had a spectacular view anyway of the eclipse lying on his back.
David, one thing I thought was really interesting is that there were female astronomers that made their way out west for the eclipse. Mariah Mitchell from Vassar and her group. I thought that was, like, pretty badass of them. Like, it was really cool. And that they were kind of, you know, talking about proving, you know, themselves or trying to show that they could do astronomy just as well as the menfolk could do.
That's really neat. Mitchell, who, as you know, was really the most famous female scientist in America at that time. She was teaching astronomy at Vassar. And this was a time when, I mean, we can all imagine that it probably was not easy to be a working female scientist in that age, and that certainly is true. But it went even deeper than that, because this was a time when women's colleges were just getting off the ground, and there was a tremendous backlash against them. I mean, there was a book that was written by a Harvard doctor that came out in the early 1870s that claimed in all seriousness that higher education could ruin a girl's health, that if maturing girls used their brains too much, it would sap energies from their maturing reproductive organs, and they would become these sterile masculine invalids. And so it was in the face of that that Mariah Mitchell put together this all-female Eclipse expedition to Denver to show that women could be educated and smart and scientifically minded and healthy and feminine, to show that this book by Dr. Clark was just clear rubbish.
Well, and so what was the reaction of some of the folks that were out there, some of the people who are living in the West, to all these guys and ladies coming in? And, you know, were there, did they give star parties? Did they share their views? Was it kind of a mixed thing?
Oh, it was, you know, that was part of what I found so fascinating too. So you're talking to me, you know, I'm in Colorado. I live in Boulder, Colorado. And, you know, my impression of the folks who lived out here back in that era, 140 years ago, was that, you know, these were very kind of practical minded people who came out to the West. They were mining and ranching and settling. And I wouldn't have thought that they would be terribly interested in such, you know, academic things as studying the stars. But they were really fascinated. I mean, these frontiersmen and women there were these star parties that were put on by the visiting scientists, and the locals were fascinated to look at Saturn and the moon through the telescopes. And a large number of locals actually volunteered to help the scientists on Eclipse Day or to participate in some crowdsourcing efforts as well.
That part of the people who are training people how to draw the eclipse, draw what they saw, and they could, like, they gave each person a quadrant to draw.
Oh, yeah, like that was cool. And then, like, what they saw, yeah.
And then they could stitch it all together.
Exactly. That was organized by a group from the Chicago Astronomical Society, and they had hoped to bring along some students to do this, but they didn't have the funding or something, so they just put out the call for the people of Denver to participate in a corona drawing class, where the couple of nights before the eclipse, that, you know, two nights in the course of the week before the eclipse, they practiced in doing very accurate and quick sketches of what the corona might look like. And as you say, the class was divided into quadrants, so everyone was responsible for just one quarter of the corona. And then afterwards, all the drawings were put together into a single composite drawing.
Well, because we didn't really know what the corona was. So when the totality happened and people saw that, the scientists weren't quite convinced as what it was. And is that where kind of Thomas Edison comes into play to investigate the corona?
Right. So, yeah, the corona was a great mystery. I mean, in fact, it until a little bit before the eclipse of 1878, it was even thought that maybe it wasn't attached to the sun, that there was a theory that perhaps it was actually the moon's atmosphere being backlit by the sun. And then when they did think it was somehow part of the sun, it didn't make sense that it was really an atmosphere in any sense that we think of it in terms of the Earth or planets. So, yeah, there were all sorts of efforts to study it. And Thomas Edison, in the lead-up to the eclipse of 1878, actually came up with a new device specifically to study the corona. It was called the tazimeter, and it was an extremely sensitive heat detector that he was going to use to see if the corona maybe didn't just give off light, but actually gave off heat as well.
And this was before his light bulb invention, right? So he was a household name, but not world famous, I guess.
Well, in just the months before the eclipse, he had come out with the phonograph. And that what really launched him from being a successful but little known inventor he had just become a global celebrity. And so he had reporters following him and interviewing him all the way to Wyoming and back. And then as soon as he returned to New Jersey, the very day after he got back from his eclipse expedition, he started work on the light bulb. So 1878 is a key year in the life of Thomas Edison.
Well, there was one anecdote about when they're riding out west on the train, and you wrote something that Edison would ride on the cowcatcher.
Yeah.
In the front of the train?
Exactly. Yeah, and it's true, and he wasn't the only one to do it. One of the other scientists who was with him, Henry Morton, who was the president of the Stevens Institute of Technology, he wrote in his diary, which I found in the Stevens Institute archives, that he was also riding on the cowcatcher. And there were a few other scientists who did it. I guess it was a thing to do if you could get permission to take a cushion and sit out in front.
In the front of the train.
Take in the view. You know, you were going like 30 miles an hour, which is pretty fast back then.
Yeah, so I guess we weren't whipping our way like 60 or 70, but still.
Right. You still wouldn't want to fall off.
No.
And what about the cows?
And the cows, too. That's right. That's why they call it the cowcatcher.
Yeah, really. Yeah, right. Like, I want to sit there. Yeah. Like, how about I sit behind the person that's sitting in the cowcatcher? They can sort of be the first line of defense.
Well, you don't get the coal smoke, I guess. You don't get the smoke blowing on you. You get the clear view.
I still like that Thomas Edison had paparazzi following him around. That's pretty cool. Like, good for him.
He definitely had reporters following him around. And that, you know, it was just so much fun writing about him. And because, you know, I was turning up all along the route from New Jersey to Wyoming. And then he went to California and came back. You know, basically at every stop, the local paper had a reporter there to talk to Edison.
Wow.
So there was lots of material for me to work with.
Well, and so where did you end up seeing the total eclipse here in 2017?
Well, I was up in Wyoming. So again, living in Colorado, Wyoming made sense, and it also was nice to be. I actually should say I was right where the eclipse of 1878 intersected with the total eclipse of 2017.
Cool. That is cool.
Which is just south of Yellowstone National Park. So I was up at the southern end of Grand Teton National Park, up on a mountaintop at 10,400 feet.
Wow.
And I actually chose that spot because of what Cleveland Abbey and the others on Pikes Peak reported in 1878. They, from being at such high an altitude, they had a remarkable view of the eclipse. First of all, seeing the corona in the thin air with less atmosphere to look through, it just was incredibly vivid. And then they were able to look up to the northwest and see the moon's shadow coming in toward them across the mountains.
Yeah, so
and
could you see
what
that?
I wanted to see. No.
Oh, you couldn't. You couldn't see them covering up each peak on the way over?
No. I mean, so I thought I had picked the right spot, and I think they're just. I have two thoughts about it. One is, although I was on a very high peak, I could not see directly down into the Snake River Plain of Idaho. There were a couple peaks between me and the plain. So I couldn't look down onto the plain to actually see the shadow crossing the land. But I could see peaks in the distance, and the whole western sky darkened noticeably, but not as a defined curtain, which is what the folks on Pikes Peak saw. So I think also it probably depends on the angle and size of the shadow on any given eclipse. I mean, this was my sixth total solar eclipse.
Oh, wow.
And I have yet to see the moon's shadow as a clear, dark curtain coming toward me, which others have seen. I mean, not only from mountaintops, but also at sea. I think it just, you know, you just have to have the right conditions of the angle being in the right way from your position. So I'm going to keep looking, but I didn't see it this year.
And you would never, ever assume that these people took artistic license with their descriptions.
Scientists are accurate.
Cleveland Abbey was using his second glasses. Remember, he wasn't using his good glasses.
Left him on the mountain.
I have to take that his observations a little grain of salt.
Well, there were several people who said the same thing. And as I say, and you, I don't know if you've ever seen the moon's shadow approach in a very clear way, but I've had
friends of mine
have seen it, and they've said it looked like a storm coming at them from the west.
Yeah. That's about what I saw in the 2006. I was on the Mediterranean Sea, and you could see it. That's a pretty good description, I'd say. You can just barely detect it. But well, this has been so great, David. We really thank you for talking to us and taking the time. And it's a great, great book. We've been talking with David Barron, journalist and author of American Eclipse, which is available at your local bookstores and online. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to visiting you in 2024.
Oh, yeah. Come up to Ohio. We'll be glad to host.
Cincinnati Observatory has been around since the mid-1800s, so you can only imagine the many letters we've received in that time. And some have very interesting questions or unique beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, since this is our eclipse, post-eclipse show, I thought we could, you know, kind of talk about some of the calls we've taken or had taken, and then some emails and things of people that are just not sure how to view the eclipse.
Oh, yeah. We got some interesting questions, especially from teachers and schools. Which one were you thinking of?
Well, I just, you know, some of the – I thought it was interesting that there were some schools that – they were worried about, well, and some parents, to be fair, you know, that were worried about their kids just looking, staring right into the sun, and they wanted to keep them from doing that, which, can you imagine? I mean, like.
Well, yeah, here it was a Monday afternoon. The kids are in school. At least a lot of the schools had started. And so it's
first
up to
the,
it's up to the teachers to be responsible and keep kids safe. So, yeah, I think we had the one question that one of the teachers said, well, should we dismiss the kids later so they don't go outside during the eclipse? And I thought, what? Why would you do that? can't you trust your kids to not stare at the sun? Like,
apparently not.
Well, I mean, but schools, like, they canceled recess. Mm-hmm. There was one teacher that told me that the principal forbade them all, teachers and kids, from going outside at all during the eclipse. And this was like the most horrible thing I'd ever heard in my life. It was just like,
okay, that's hyperbole.
Okay, that's a little too much. But it was a sad state that, you know, you think, well, here we have this eclipse that we've prepared for, that we know how to look at it safely. There's lots of different methods to do it. And unfortunately, they weren't able to. And so what I like to think of is, well, okay, to the principals out there and to the teachers out there, get prepared for 2024. Mm-hmm. There are so many safe ways to look for this. And April 8th, 2024 will be a Monday, probably be a school day also. And we'd love to have every kid in the whole country be able to see this partial eclipse that's going to happen that day. And so definitely get prepared, because if you don't, if you don't,
here it comes,
and the school next to you does, how's that going to look for you?
Oh, I thought you were going to, like, personally be like, if you don't, Dean Regas is going to rain down the fire on you or something. Like,
I will make the sun turn black if you do not.
That's right.
If you want the sun back. Okay, I guess not. That's okay, too much. Like,
and, you know, we'll be selling those glasses out of the back of your car for at a premium, but a very fair price for schools.
Gotta
care about the kids.
Fair price for the schools, definitely. We wouldn't gouge the school, not the children.
No, but bulk pricing.
But definitely, that was one of the big, I think we put that in the crank file because of all these things that actually people thought that if you look at the total eclipse, you'll go blind. Like, it's something that, you know, the sun's always dangerous, right? Didn't your mom tell you that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't look at
some,
so
it's any day.
Any day. That's
just
right.
Don't
it's a normal
stare at it.
So if you can trust your students to go outside on a normal day and not blind themselves,
which is a big if.
You think that's well, we can trust them on one more day.
Kids today.
You never know. That's true. But I think we can trust the kids.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to David Barron for joining us. And get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast, or drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
And you can ask us questions, give us topic suggestions, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we'll try to answer them on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes and rate us there, or on Stitcher, or from wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Rick Andrus is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.